Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Well, hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, on our last program, we began discussing the challenges of the Middle East at the time of World War I. And, of course, we're into chapter 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. Now, again, I just want to emphasize, we should realize that this chapter is important because it shows clearly that the problems of today's Middle East are beyond men's ability to solve. Our modern Middle East is a product of the tragically flawed nature of man. And man's nature is going to have to be radically changed before today's Middle East problems can be fixed to the benefit of all the nations living there. Now, today, what I want to do is I want to just get right back into last week's discussion. And if you remember, towards the end of the program, we were talking about Sharif Hussein. And remember that the main theme of these two programs are the duplicity or the double dealing that every side involved in the Middle East was involved in. The British, you know, were double dealers even with each other. The Arabs were double dealers with each other. The Arabs were double dealers with the British. The British with the Arabs. The French were involved. Lawrence had his own, issues with duplicity. We're going to talk about that more towards the conclusion of this program. And even among themselves, the Arabs, you know, had this problem, and it's a human problem. We can be, let's say, conniving, deceitful people. And, when you're trying to solve problems between nations, I mean, it's just so much better to be truthful and honest and get everything out on the table to solve the problem. But so often, you know, we have our own secret agendas and, we keep our desires secret to ourselves and we try and manipulate the situation to get what we want. And the world will never have peace as long as mankind, you know, lives a deceitful or a double dealing or a duplicitous life. Now, remember Lawrence, if you remember back to just the end of the last program, Lawrence was on his way to see Hussein, remember he had declared himself king of the Hejaz, which was really against what the British wanted and certainly was against what the French wanted. And it really was not very comfortable for the other Arabic peoples, especially Ibn Saud. And again, if you don't know who Ibn Saud was, I know you know who Saudi Arabia is. And so he was he crowned himself, I think, king of Saudi Arabia. And of course, there's a royal family still in charge there today. But Lawrence did go to see King Hussein or Sharif Hussein. And, he did meet him and talk with him. And the thing is King Hussein was really suspicious of Lawrence. And, of course, Korda does make some conjecture as to why he was suspicious. And remember, I mean, Lawrence was still pretty young at the time. King Hussein or Sharif Hussein was much older than he was. And the thing is he may have just been cautious of Lawrence's youth. Remember, Lawrence was very ambitious, and but he really came through and he delivered on his ambitions. And but still, if you're an older man, sometimes the ambitions of youth can really, let's say, scare an older person. And sometimes older people are right about those kind of things. Now the point is, the other thing that Korda brings out is, he may have been afraid of Lawrence's growing influence over his son Faisal. And I think we told you at the very beginning that Faisal and Lawrence got along famously together. I mean, they had a deep love for each other. and they really worked well together. Now, that doesn't mean they had the same, that Lawrence had the same relationship with the other brothers. And even on the last program, I did tell you that even the brothers had trouble getting along with each other, and they had their own agendas, and they were double dealing with each other. But another thing is, you have to remember that he knew that Lawrence was really into the Arab cause, but he didn't. He was really suspicious of, was he in it for the Arabs, or was he in it for the colonialism or the empire, building empire of the British? I mean, that's what he was wondering. What is their agenda? And remember, according to David Lloyd George, the British wanted Jerusalem. They wanted to protect Jerusalem. And if you even go back to the history of the Crusades, I mean, there are a lot of the kings, the ancient kings of England, they fought in the Crusades to protect Jerusalem from the Turks. And so remember, three holy sites, for the Islamic people, one of the number one big ones is Jerusalem. And so the British always were going to be involved with, to keep, Jerusalem together, or to keep Jerusalem under, at least British control. And I am going to have at least two programs on the Balfour Declaration, and I'm getting prepared for those now as we're getting working on these programs right now. And then for all of you out there, remember, we're just back into classes here at our Imperial Academy. And, of course, James Brandon is working very hard over there, and we're both, my wife and I are both back into teaching. I'm working with English language literature this semester. Next year at Shakespeare, my wife teaches cooking. She has a large cooking class, and she actually has, cooking labs, and then we have an associated lab with all of our students in Edstone. So she's really busy, and I'll be hoping to get both James and my wife back in on the panels here pretty quickly. And so we just have to keep moving forward. But, we've been talking about the idea of double dealing, or being duplicitous, or maybe you could even say being a dissembler. And when Lawrence met King Hussein, it turns out that he was probably the better dissembler of them all. And he did not have a lot of good things to say about Lawrence. Here's what Corda says. This is on page 300 now. It says, in any case, this is kind of breaking into the middle of the paragraph. I mean, Lawrence could not get any influence with Hussein, but here's someone who could. It says, in any case, Colonel Wilson, General Wingate's patient and long-suffering representative in Jeddah, managed to talk Hussein around to the advantage of putting Faisal under Allenby's command instead of his own. And with that, the king lapsed into a long and discursive description. And here's a quote, as usual, without obvious coherence. Now, what the British learned about Sharif Hussein, or King Hussein as he declared himself, is that if he didn't want to answer a question, he would give a long discourse on his religious beliefs. And Corda says this was a tactic he seems to have used with the British visitors to prevent them from asking questions he did not want to answer. For their part, both Wilson and Lawrence were embarrassed by the suppositions that they knew more about the Sykes-Picot Agreement than the king did, and by trying to put the best light on it if they could, wasted effort, since the king by now surely knew more about the treaty than he let on and was better at dissembling than either of them. And so here, the Sykes-Picot Agreement was supposed to be the secret agreement, and looks like the King Hussein knew a lot about it. And so that's why he didn't trust Lawrence. But again, it was Colonel Wilson that was able to get him to agree to put Faisal under Allenby, which is what they needed to have happen. Now, here's something that's really, really, kind of interesting, and it just shows a little bit of Lawrence's character. So I put all this together. The You know, the Arabs have finally started their revolt. You know, the British have finally committed to the Arabs. They gave them gold, and they're giving them ammunition. And so what do you think Lawrence does after he meets with Hussein? They finally get the answer. What do you think he does? Does he want to get right back into it? And the thing that this is, to me, it's just really kind of humorous, is Lawrence is such a gutsy guy, he decides to make a special trip to Mecca. Now, remember, he comes from a Christian country. They don't want Christians in Mecca. And why does he go to Mecca? And again, I think this reveals his personality. I'm going to read it to you. This is page 300, bottom of the page. Lawrence seems to have made a quick, unauthorized visit to Mecca, a city closed to unbelievers, certainly without the knowledge of the king or Faisal, to shop for a gold dagger to replace one that he had given to a Hawitat chief. For an Arab of Lawrence's rank, to go without a curved gold dagger in his belt was the equivalent of being half naked, and he was determined to have the best and the lightest dagger that could be made, one that would establish his sheriffian status at a glance. Though in general, Lawrence disliked being tied down possessions, there were certain areas in which he was unapologetically extravagant and in which only the best would do. Pistols. Here's what Lawrence liked. Pistols, fine bookbindings, motorcycles, the art he commissioned for Seven Pillars of Wisdom, and the famous dagger were all examples of this. He would later write in detail about ordering the dagger from a goldsmith named Gassin. And there's a quote from Seven Pillars of Wisdom. It says, in the third little turning to the left off the main bazaar. So he even gives the address. And once it was delivered, he would wear it through the rest of the war whenever he was in Arab dress. It would become something of a trademark and was often wrongly described as being the symbol of a prince of Mecca, a title which did not exist and which he never claimed. So in the middle of all this finagling going on and all the dissembling and all the duplicity, Lawrence has the gall and the guts to go into Mecca to get a gold dagger so that he looks like a Sharifian. And so, you know, they did, the Arabs loved him, and he did have Sharifian status, but he needed to have that gold dagger or he just couldn't be happy. And, of course, we remember from before how many, you know, rugs he sent home. He'd buy these rugs. He'd buy up these beautiful rugs made in the Middle East, and he'd send them home. Anyway, I think that's really kind of hilarious. So he risked his life, actually, for a gold dagger. All right. Now, we've talked about, you know, what was going on with the British, what was going on with their double dealing, and we didn't get too hard on the French because actually Corda doesn't tell us too much. But we know that Lawrence really hated the French because they wanted to impose their culture on the Arabs. But here's one thing that's really kind of, I think it's really kind of interesting, is even after the taking of Aqaba, there was something that the British had to learn about the Arabs. And if you remember one of the characters from back all the way back to chapter 2, it was, and I hope I say this right, Ada Uba Tei and his Hawitat, those were the Hawitat people. Essentially, they weren't getting their gold fast enough. And if you've even seen the Peter O'Toole movie on Lawrence of Arabia, there's that one scene where Abu, the actor playing Ada Abu Tai, they're in hunting for the gold and they can't find the gold and he's so upset. So that was really true. This guy really was into his gold. And he didn't think he was getting the gold and the armor, like the guns and the ammunition that he needed. And so essentially what he did is he started into secret negotiations with the Turks to make a peace treaty with them. And here they just started to fight them. And, you know, Lawrence found out about this. And, of course, if that happened, if Ada would be, we'll just call him Ada, if Ada would make this secret negotiation work with the Turks, then they would lose Aqaba. I mean, all that effort to get Aqaba, and if you remember, they almost, you know, singed themselves to death in the desert with all the bugs and the heat and the, I mean, it was just a wretched effort to take Aqaba. And, you know, even the Turks had told Lawrence it could never be done, but it was done. And so that's the last thing that, you know, Lawrence wanted. And so essentially what he did is he decided to make a surprise visit to see Adda Abu. And Korda talks about this on page 300. It's the second paragraph. It says, "The pleasure Lawrence felt at the king's rapid ascent was marred by news from Cairo that Adda Abu Ta'i and his Howitat were in secret negotiations with the Turks, which, if they succeeded, would have meant the loss of Aqaba and everything that Lawrence had planned. Lawrence's naval friend, Captain Boyle, provided him with a fast arms steamship, HMS Hardinge, to take him at flank speed north to Aqaba, where Nasser told him that the Turks had indeed already retaken several outposts and gave him a swift camel and a guide to take him to Adda's camp in the desert." So you can see that Lawrence was really kind of fearless. I mean, if you know anything, let's say if you even saw the movie, Peter with Peter O'Toole, I mean, Adda Abu, this really kind of a scary guy. I mean, they did a good job with makeup and everything. And so the thing is he was a warrior, and he was also different than the British. Now, what Lawrence decided to do was to surprise Adda, and he did. And here's a quote. He says, "He dropped in on them, walking unarmed into Adda's tent, where the old warrior was in conversation with his confederates, just in time to join their meal." So think about that. I mean, how cool-headed is Adda? I mean, he obviously has to suspect that Lawrence knows something's up. And here, Lawrence walks in unarmed, just totally bold. And so they invite him to have dinner. And so he sits down and has dinner with them. So Korda goes on to say, "After the ritual, fulsome greetings of desert courtesy, Lawrence revealed that he knew about Adda's correspondence with the Turks and was able to quote phrases from letters that had passed between Adda and the governor of Man. Adda dismissed it all with a laugh. Unbeknownst to him, he explained, one of his men who could read and write had sent a letter to the Turkish governor under Adda's seal, seeking out terms for his switching sides. The governor had agreed on a price and to demand for a down payment. When Adda found out about it, he caught the messenger with the gold in the desert and robbed him to the skin for his own benefit. It was a matter of business, brigandage being the main business of the Bedouin." And so essentially what you have here is Adda is just totally lying. He's saying, I didn't get in contact with the governor. I didn't get in contact with the Turks. Well, that was one of my men who could read and write. He wrote the letters. He just wanted the gold. And so I went and stole the gold from him. You know, it's absolute farce. And, Lawrence knew it was a farce. And so, there was a lot of respect for Lawrence among the Arabs. And so I guess they both just laughed it off and, had a good meal. But here's what Korda says, and this is where Lawrence was just really sharp. He says, "Behind this farce, however, Lawrence correctly divined that Adda had grievances strong enough to tempt him to seek out better terms from the Turks, one of them being that Lawrence was receiving more attention than Adda for the capture of Aqaba." Now, that's hilarious. Lawrence is getting a lot of attention over Aqaba. Adda was upset that he wasn't getting the attention. And so look at the nature of that man. You know, it's like, where was his attitude towards the Arab cause? You know, he said, well, man, I'm not getting enough attention, so I'm going to negotiate with my enemy. And so that's what happened. So, but Lawrence was smart enough, and he told Otto right away, he says, look, the gold's on the way, there's rifles on the way, there's ammunition on the way, there's food on the way. And he said there's a down payment on the gold that would be coming to Otta as soon as Faisal arrived in Aqaba with the rest of the army. So it seems like this meeting ended like two old friends. They laughed it off. And but Lawrence, I guess, Korda tells us, he really learned a lesson there that, look, if you're going to work with the Bedouin, and they're pretty cold, they're crafty people, and if they are expecting gold, you better deliver the gold. And, you know, they wanted those British sovereigns, and, you know, they weren't getting them. And so they were going to blow the whole effort to take Aqaba just because they didn't get what they wanted. And then, again, you know, Otto wanted the attention that Lawrence was getting. So the thing is, what we have to understand here is Lawrence goes back to the home base, and essentially what he does is he lies to his superiors. And Korda brings this out in a great way. He says, showing a capacity for duplicity that equaled Otta's, Lawrence then returned to the Hardinge to Cairo, where he declared that he had looked into the situation and that there was no spirit of treachery abroad, and vouched for Otta's loyalty. Korda says, in this, Lawrence recognized a great truth. The crowd wanted book heroes and would never understand the complexity of a man like Otta, who not only was moved by greed for gold, but as a tribal leader would always want to keep a way open to the enemy. And so here was Arab politics, and the thing is, the British really didn't understand it, but Lawrence did, and Lawrence did not trust the British to understand it. And so what he did is he just hid the whole picture, and he hid what Otto was actually doing. And can you imagine, how can you work with people like that, that are greedy for gold, and then if they don't get what they want, they're going to negotiate with the enemy to get what they want? And of course, the Turkish people were ready to give them gold, you know, to stop their losing the empire. So here's what Korda says here. It says, Arab politics, an instinctive survival mechanism that would emerge in the moments of setback or defeat, and that had to be concealed at all costs from the simpler minds of the British leader. And so that's what Lawrence believed, that Arab politics were instinctive survival mechanisms. And how many of our, let's say, officials today or our world leaders are reading a book like this and, working with the Arabs? And even if you look at Europe today, you know, here we had this supposedly this nuclear agreement with Iran, and they had this nuclear agreement with Iran, and now Iran is holding them at bay with it, saying that you better do this, this, and this, or we're going to go back to making uranium. And, people got into this deal with Iran thinking they're going to tell the truth. And, here's a good book that will just absolutely explain, how can you trust them? And, they're going to get what they want. They're going to get what they feel like they need. And they'll work with you as long as it's going their way. But if it doesn't go their way, they're going to go their own way. And so, the world is still going to have to deal with Iran. And, those things are just, coming into play here pretty quickly. Now, one thing that I think is really kind of noble on Korda's part is he does, show that Lawrence himself used duplicity at this time. And, here's the quote from the bottom of page 302. It says, Lawrence's duplicity has been an issue for some who have written about him, and in fact, a number of biographies are intended to debunk him wholly or in part. He said this is partly Lawrence's own fault. He sometimes embellished the truth, and he invariably placed himself at the center of events. But it must be said that when the British government finally released most of the papers and documents relating to Lawrence, almost everything he claimed was confirmed in meticulous detail. Sir Ernest Dowson, KBE, the Director General of the Egyptian Survey, who had clashed sharply with Lawrence over the transliteration of Arabic place names on maps in 1914 and later became an admirer, remarked on his puckishness and went on to comment, "Many men of sense and ability were repelled by the impudence, freakishness, and frivolity he trained so provocatively, and regarded him in consequence at the bottom as a posturing stage player whose tinsel exploits were the fruits of free, lavish gold." Dowson also shrewdly observed that it was idle to pretend he was not ambitious. He was vastly so, but like all men of large caliber, he was ambitious for achievement rather than recognition. And so the thing is, Lawrence was also guilty of it, but in many ways, it was an embellishment of the truth, and it was there to really help people, not harm people. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. So next time, we will finish our discussion of chapter 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. And remember, for this current series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can also find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So please write me any comments you may have to jbl@pcog.org. I'd really like to know what you think of this chapter, 1917, The Uncrowned King of Arabia. You can also follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So, until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG. Streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.